This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The 2020 US elections was billed by many as the battle for the soul of America. The progressive left-wing Democratic Party slugging it out to defeat the right-wing, racist, xenophobic, conservative Republican Party led by the all-evil Donald Trump. Joe Biden's win was celebrated as a victory for the progressives. But what if it's all just a performance? What if I told you that the United States of America actually has two right-wing parties? I'm Darshan Johan, and this is Today I Learned. On the show with me today is Assistant Professor Peter Beattie. He's a lecturer in global political economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Welcome to the show, Peter. Good to have you on again.
Thank you, Darshan. Happy to be back.
You've mentioned a number of times in conversations with me on and off our shows that when we look at the US alone, it seems, broadly speaking, like the Democrats are left-wing and the Republicans are right-wing. But you've also mentioned that when we look at global politics, the Democrats are most definitely right-wing. Why do you say so?
Well, because if you look at a number of issues, but the biggest one would be foreign policy or military policy. There isn't that much difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party when it comes to the use of the war machine, the military-industrial complex. There are different factions within the foreign policy establishment in the U.S., a.k.a. the blob in D.C. But, you know, you have a broad consensus on most foreign policy issues. And that goes across Republican and Democratic Party. So that's really the main reason why I don't think it's accurate to call either of those two parties left wing, because nowhere else in the world is it a common, normal part of political conversation to discuss what country to invade or what country to begin bombing or what country to put under crippling economic sanctions that kill lots of civilians. So this is a fundamentally right-wing characteristic of both parties, the militarism of both parties. But I mean, there are plenty of other examples, like in terms of immigration policy. You know, if you look at the number of people deported under Barack Obama's administration, it was greater than the number of people deported under the George W. Bush administration and, of course, the Trump administration. If you look at healthcare policy, you'll have at least some people within the Democratic Party arguing for a more, you know, a basic civilized healthcare system that all other rich countries in the world and lots of not so rich countries in the world have been enjoying for decades now. But neither party, including the Democratic Party, is really pushing seriously to shift the system to one that covers everyone. And the reasons are basically the same. But for those are the three main policy areas I would point you to understand why I don't think it's accurate to call the Democratic Party a left party on a global spectrum. It's only left-ish in the U.S. spectrum.
But Peter, many will point to the fact that you know, when it comes to what is being said, or you know, the ideologies taken up by these political parties, people will say that you know, yes, they may have similar military policies and all of that, but perhaps that's just the American way. I mean, we say it's obviously it's wrong, but you know, that's just an American thing. But apart from that, you know, when people will say that, you know, if you look at the Democrats, they have very left leaning social ideologies. People will say the Democrats, for example, are not racist. They are not xenophobic. They are pro-choice when it comes to abortion. They are pro-LGBTQ marriages, for example, LGBTQ rights.
Well, I think that's a fair point. I just don't think that the mostly it's just rhetoric. You know, you have a lot of Democratic politicians and Democratic Party operatives who will use kind of social justice rhetoric and woke posturing when they're talking about the rights of women, sexual identity minorities, ethnic minorities, et cetera. But when it comes down to policy, I mean, we've seen a lot of change in terms of LGBT rights. And so that's, you could point to that as a concrete example. But when it, in general, it's really just rhetoric. There's very little policy that actually gets implemented to really improve the lives of historically disadvantaged groups, like, you know, again, women, sexual identity minorities, ethnic minorities, immigrants, et cetera. So yeah, in that sense, the Democratic Party is more left-ish, but it's just in that one little area of social issues. And even there, I wouldn't be too confident or comfortable saying that they're really truly left on social issues, because a lot of it is just rhetoric that excites a certain part of their base to come and vote for them. But you know, when you ask, you know, what are the actual policies that are implemented beyond what has been done to kind of give marriage rights to LGBT people, there's very little by way of, you know, concrete action that you could point to and say, ah, yes, well, at least on social issues, the Democratic Party is truly left. And my broader point, though, is that when you compare the importance of social issues to the importance of military power, you know, when you're talking about military, war and peace, you're talking about human lives lost. That's a very different level of seriousness than when you're talking about, you know, even ending forms of discrimination against traditionally oppressed or historically oppressed minorities.
So if that's the case, then what's the difference between Democrats and the Republicans? You know, we talk about rhetoric, political posturing, and you know, riling up certain parts of their base, right? But if there are very little that differentiates the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of policymaking, in terms of changing the lives of the average Americans, then what exactly are the people going to the ballot box for and voting?
So I think what the people are voting for in the Republican Party, you know, if some people, a minority, I think, that are voting from, you know, like white nationalist ideas, or, you know, they watch Fox News and they think that the white population is under threat and the white population is oppressed. And so there, you have a minority thinking in those terms. You have another part of the party that really just cares about business. They think that the Republican Party is better because they reduce government regulation and they reduce taxes. You've got a lot of people in the Republican Party that vote for them solely because of the issue of abortion. If you really do believe that abortion is the exact same thing as murder, then that is your predominant issue. Just like, you know, I mentioned before, I think military policy is far more important than social issues in the US. Well, for these people, they think the exact same way because they think that abortion is murder. So they'll only vote for Republicans just because of that one issue. I guess you've got others who think in a broader religious sense, that they think that the Republican Party is better on the religious issues that matter. That includes abortion, but it also includes, you know, the Republican politicians don't talk so much about gay rights, so they like that. So you've got this kind of coalition of different groups that vote for the Republicans for different reasons. And it's the same or similar in the Democratic Party. Again, just like with the Republicans, you've got different groups that vote for the Democrats for different reasons. So you also have a section of the economic elite, the wealthy, that vote for Democrats because they think that the Democrats will be more responsible stewards of U.S. capitalism, and they will favor the industries of the future, tech, internet, pharmaceuticals, et cetera, biotech. And they recognize that the rich should pay a higher proportion of their income and perhaps even wealth, because they also want to have a more or less balanced budget. So you do have people voting for the Democrats for kind of from a pro-business perspective. They just have a different understanding of how the economy operates and what policies would be good for, you know, the economy. And you also have activists who vote for the Democratic Party, people that want more social justice, and they vote for the Democrats because they support more abortion rights. They're better on LGBT rights. They support a slightly better social safety net. They're rhetorically better on immigration, and the Democrats all often promise, you know, we want to do immigration reform to make lives easier for immigrants. But again, I would point out the difference between rhetoric and policy that you can see very clearly when you look at the Obama administration's record versus George W. Bush administration's record. Mm-hmm. So my point is not that, my argument isn't that there aren't any differences between the parties. My point is that within the US, people are kept ignorant of the kind of true range of political options. They're shown in TV and newspapers only a very truncated, small portion of the true range of political debate. So within that small range, they see differences between the parties, particularly in rhetorical terms and kind of cultural signaling terms, but they're not aware of the true range of possibilities on economic policy, and certainly kept unaware of the range of possibilities on foreign policy and military policy. And so that's why you have people like Gore Vidal. He put it really brilliantly, I thought. He said the U.S. has one political party, the property party, with two right wings, the Republicans and Democrats. And even better than that, the Tanzanian politician Julius Nyerere said, he put it, the United States is also a one-party state, but with typical American extravagance, they have two of them.
So would you say that when it comes to economic policies as well, yes, there are some differences between the Republicans and the Democrats, but they are mostly a pro big business capitalist parties. Would you say both sides are the same in that sense?
Absolutely. And the main difference there is, while they're both pro big business, there are different coalitions of business interest groups that tend to favor the Republicans, and then other coalitions of business that tend to favor the Democrats. And if you're interested in that, Tom Ferguson is a really great US political scientist who has traced the different coalitions of investors that have lined up behind the Republicans and Democrats going back about 100 years.
Hmm. Now, Peter, I was reading something called the Ratchet Effect. Now, some argue that the powers that be wants the United States to be incredibly right-wing. So what happens is when Republicans are in office, the gears, the ratchet starts spinning, right-wing policies get passed, right-wing judges are appointed, so on and so forth. And naturally, this will cause, you know, many Americans to get frustrated. And so when the frustration, you know, keeps building and building and building, and then the next election comes along and Democrats get voted into office. But what this happens is, you know, it's done simply to appease people. The Democrat Party that gets voted in, you know, doesn't actually fight for significant left-wing progressive policies. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate observation. I'm not so sure about there being kind of like a master plan. I think this is sort of more of just an emergent phenomenon that you know, arises because of the interaction of lots of different actors within the political economic system. But nonetheless, like what you described, I think is perfectly accurate. And you can see it, you know, in many different areas. But I guess just as one example, you could look at the top marginal tax rate. So the rate on money that you make that's like over 100,000, over 200,000, whatever the cutoff point is. And under Reagan, that tax rate was cut significantly. And then you might think, oh, okay, well, if you have this quote-unquote two-party system and the Democrats want to have a more progressive, fairer tax system so that you don't have the accumulation of massive fortunes among a very small handful of people, you would think that when they get into power, then they'll move that tax rate back up. But that's not what we see at all. The Democrats essentially haven't done anything to move the top tax rate back up. And then when Republicans get back in office, just as a ratchet would work, they then move the tax rate even lower, and then it stays there. The amount, there's a little bit of pushback. I think it was Obama, the top marginal rate was moved up by a couple of percentage points, but it's still massively below what it was in the 1950s, 1960s, even under Republican administrations back then. The other example I was thinking of was trade policy, neoliberal trade policy, where trade deals are basically written by corporate lawyers to favor their clients. You know, whatever their clients want in a trade deal, they'll write it in, and then it'll be promoted as a quote unquote free trade deal. So you had, of course, Reagan pushing for these kinds of trade policies, but even under Clinton, they were able to pass the North American Free Trade Act, NAFTA, and that was a further rightward shift in economic policy. And so, you know, that's the kind of exception to the ratchet effect, where it's not just stopping where the Republicans left it; it's actually moving further right under the Democrats. So right. That's the one area where there's a little exception to the ratchet effect.
Why does this happen, and what are the consequences of this? Does that mean that over a period of time, the country has just become more and more right-wing over the years? Because if the right-wing parties come up, you know, during their reign, they do 10 steps or 10 different things, for example. And then when the Democrats come into power, they barely push back on that. Perhaps they do something, some damage control, you know, just to appease the people. And, you know, so 10 steps, and then let's say the Democrats minus 2 steps, so it becomes eight steps towards the right, instead of making it, you know, back to zero or swinging it completely in the other direction. So if it's a constant 10 steps towards the right, 2 steps towards the left, 10 steps towards the right, 2 steps towards the left, then does that mean that over a period of however many years, now the country is just more right than it's ever been?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, outside of social issues, again, that I think is perfectly accurate. And the fundamental reason for it is just the basic structure of the U.S. political economy, where it's relatively easy to translate economic power, financial power, money into political power. You do it through direct campaign contributions are the most obvious form. But you do it in a number of different ways. So you hire lobbyists, and lobbyists are just smart people and come up with very intelligent, very convincing sounding rationalizations for their clients' desires. But they make it seem like what their client wants, some wealthy investor or business owner, what that person wants is actually good for the whole country. So you get a bunch of smart people together in a room, they devise these justifications and rationalizations. And then you have your lobbyists go and take, you know, Congress people out to lunch and dinner, talk to their staffers, try to convince them of this argument. So that's lobbying. You also have various forms of propaganda. So one common way of translating economic power into political power is you start a think tank. And again, you hire a bunch of smart people. And if there is an issue like healthcare reform, where people are saying, hey, look around Europe, look around rich countries in Asia, they all have healthcare systems that work a hell of a lot better than ours. Shouldn't we maybe just adopt what works in the rest of the world? Well, you get your think tank together, you get a bunch of smart people in the think tank, and they come up with rationalizations and justifications for the existing absolute failure of a system. And then they write reports, they promote the reports in the media, they send copies of the reports to everyone in Washington, D.C. Another way is to fund university departments or chairs at universities, particularly in relevant areas of academic inquiry, like economics. So you make sure that you fund a new university chair, and you make sure that the economist who is hired to take up that position is a right-wing economist who believes that the best possible economic system is one in which there is no government regulation, or it's as minimal as possible, and tax rates are low. So through all of these various means, you can turn your economic power into political power, and that is what has shaped both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party into the fundamentally right-wing parties they both are. Minus social issues for the Democrats, of course.
Now, are the two right-wing parties then representative of the American people? Because you mentioned the word clients, and I think that's a very interesting word to use when discussing politics, right? Because in an ideal world, in a world where politics is functioning at its best, the clients of the political party should be the people. But what you're saying is essentially the clients of these political parties are the big businesses. So then do these political parties represent American people of today? Are the two right-wing parties, do they sort of embody the collective values, vision, aspirations of the American people? I'm wondering, are the parties a reflection of the people, or do the parties exist in spite of what the people want?
Well, that is oftentimes considered to be a contentious issue or an issue of debate, but there really isn't any real debate to be had on that issue. That's been answered empirically. And until someone does a better empirical investigation with opposite results, I think it's pretty solid. It's pretty much a settled question. And that is, the average person in the United States has no measurable impact on political outcomes. So there's the famous paper. Basically, what they did was they looked over several decades and they got public opinion polls, and they looked at the policy preferences of Americans by their level of income or wealth. And what they found was that the policy preferences of the bottom 90% had zero measurable impact on the actual laws that were passed into law. Instead, the top 10%, if there was a consensus among the richest Americans on a given policy, that policy had a very high chance of being passed into law. So as an empirical matter, it's very clear that the political system comprising both parties works exclusively for the interests of the very richest. And even in that paper and subsequent papers, they pointed out that, you know, their measurement of wealth was relatively rough. And they expect that, in fact, it's really just like the top 1 or 0.1% that's really driving these outcomes, because that's where the lobbying money is concentrated. It's individual businesses or whole business sectors, probably led by a leading corporation within that sector, who see a policy issue that's going to impact their business, and then they lobby very hard to get what they want out of the system, and the opinions of the majority are irrelevant. And you can understand why that is, because why should you, as a politician, really care at all about what a majority of the population thinks when you know that in this system, people are not given this kind of information? This is not a point of discussion in the mass media every day. Journalists aren't looking at the wealthy business interests that are involved in the policymaking process. They're not looking at individual politicians and saying, oh, look, they're supported heavily by this industry, and they're in favor of this law that is going to benefit that industry. That's interesting. That kind of analysis just isn't done. There is a news article that came out from the Daily Poster, I think, last week, looking at one or two individual senators and how much they had received recently from pharmaceutical companies, and how they were instrumental in stripping a provision out of a very big bill that's being discussed and debated to basically allow the US government to negotiate drug prices, which would lower the price that the government pays to pharmaceutical companies. So that kind of analysis is extremely rare. And if you're a wealthy person and you know, or a politician, and you know that the population is going to remain ignorant of how politics actually works, then why would you pay attention to the preferences of the majority? You need to pay attention to the preferences of the people that are going to be paying your bills, the people who are going to be influencing the narrative in the media, and that's all you need to do.
On the show with me today is Assistant Professor Peter Beattie. He's a lecturer in global political economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. After the break, I'll be asking him why the US mainstream media tends to support more centrist or right-wing political candidates. We'll be back with more on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is Assistant Professor Peter Beattie, lecturer in global political economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And we're talking about why both major political parties in the US are actually right-wing. So, Peter, when we talk about, let's say, the 2020 US presidential elections in particular, now in towards the end, of course, it was about Biden, whether you like him, you don't like him. I think most of the progressives in the US were happy to just get rid of Donald Trump. But I think there was a period, as you know, in the early days of the US 2020 US presidential election, the build up towards the elections, there was a pretty exciting period because one of the popular candidates of the Democratic Party turned out to be Bernie Sanders, whose policy ideas resembles that of, let's say, the Labour Party in the New Zealand. Now, Bernie calls himself a democratic socialist, but he's more of a social democrat. But as months went on, right, the candidate that was actually selected to represent the Democrats was Joe Biden, who is very much a very kind of, I don't know, boring, old school centrist. I mean, Bernie Sanders is an old man in himself, right? But him as well as the people in his camp, who on paper at least, or on social media trends at least, they seem to be the most popular Sanders. But yet he was not selected, or he was sort of phased out. And then Joe Biden was made the main candidate of the Democratic Party. Why does this happen? What are the excuses or political realities that sort of shape this decision?
Well, I mean, the main factor would be the media system. And that explains why you had more votes for Biden, particularly after the Super Tuesday contest, where two of the major centrist candidates or center-right candidates in the Democratic primary dropped out and endorsed Biden. Because the media system is particularly on, I'm really just talking about the kind of Democratic side of the media system. So your New York Times, Washington Post newspapers, your CNNs, your MSNBCs on cable, they portray a Sanders and the Sanders campaign in an overwhelmingly negative light, and they portray the Biden campaign in a generally positive light. That's really the key thing, because again, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but the research that's been done in the public opinion area shows that the overwhelming majority of people in the US know very little about politics. So even though pundits on TV will analyze political contests as if what's going on is millions of people have a well-developed political ideology, they look at the candidates and they match the candidates to their own ideology, and they say, oh, okay, well, that guy is closest to my belief, so I'm going to support him and I'm not going to support this other guy. But that's just absolutely impossible when we know very well from reams and reams of evidence that the overwhelming majority of people in the US know next to nothing about politics. They don't have a well-developed political ideology. So it becomes impossible for them to actually match their views onto the various candidates on offer. So the explanation is actually rather simple. It's just the media coverage, the tone of media coverage is more positive for the center-right candidate and is relatively negative for the center-left candidate, Sanders. And so for the majority of voters who are not very politically aware, they go, okay, well, this guy seems like a better candidate. All of my favorite Democratic politicians like Barack Obama support Biden. So I'm gonna go vote for Biden. That was really the main reason why Biden won. But if you are also asking why was it that the media and the Democratic Party establishment supported Biden.
It's interesting, right, Peter? Let's not use the word media, right? Let's use the word press. When we think about how the press is supposed to function, the press is supposed to be the fourth estate, you know? It's supposed to be there to keep governments in check. It's supposed to be the press, their clients fundamentally is supposed to be the American people, right? With that in mind, if Bernie Sanders' policy ideas are far better, far more progressive, far more beneficial to the people than, let's say, a centrist or a center-right person like Joe Biden, then why are mainstream medias, and we are not talking about Fox, like you said, we are talking about media on the progressive side of things, right? So-called, we are talking about our CNNs, our MSNBCs, and all of this. Why do they prefer someone like Joe Biden over someone like Bernie?
Well, there's been a number of surveys over the decades of journalists in the United States, and the general takeaway from them, the general trend is that working journalists tend to be center-right on economic issues and center-left on social issues. So more liberal on social issues than the general population and more conservative on economic issues than the general population. So you've got that one factor of the individual ideological perspective of journalists working in the press, but you've got a number of other pressures or forces that operate on the US media system. One is just, you know, it's a commercial media system, so you have commercial pressures. If your advertisers don't like a Sanders candidacy because they view his policies as threatening to their profitability, well, then they can put pressure on their customers, the media companies, the people that they give lots of money every year to buy advertisements, to shift coverage in a particular way. But that's just one of many forces and pressures. Another one is, if you're a journalist covering politics, you need to have access to the major players in politics, your Barack Obamas, your Nancy Pelosi's. So you want to have good relations with leaders within the party. And so, you know, they're going to be giving you a particular view of the world, and you end up transmitting that view of the world in your coverage. I'm just mentioning two. I wrote a whole book about how the U.S. media system operates as a kind of de facto propaganda system, but without any kind of top-down control. There's a lot of pressures that influence journalists and then produce the kind of biases that we see. But that's really the key part of the explanatory puzzle. Like, why did that election turn out the way it did? It's overwhelmingly due to media coverage. And you can see that as a perfect illustration in some of the post Super Tuesday primaries. They did exit polls and they found that a majority of people voting in the Democratic primary wanted to have a Medicare for all system. That is a kind of, the same kind of healthcare system that you see all throughout Europe, right?
Right.
But a majority of them voted for Joe Biden, who had on several occasions openly expressed his opposition to Medicare for all. So that's a perfect illustration of how when you have a population that is not very well informed about politics, because the way that politics is presented in the media is very low information. It focuses more on personal stories and scandals and whatnot, very little actual policy content. So people just didn't even know what policy positions the politicians had stated. But even more importantly, they were kept ignorant of the kind of political economy of political campaigns. So they didn't know which business interest groups were supporting which candidate and what that means for their likely performance in office.
On that note, right, Peter, proper leftist ideologies are slowly gaining traction in the US. I'm not sure if this is a social media era thing, or perhaps people in the US are getting more politically conscious as well. But we are seeing more leftist ideologies in the US gaining traction. We see many young politicians like, for example, AOC and Ilhan Omar pushing for policies that are genuinely leftist ideas. Does this mark a changing of America? Does this mark a point of in time where socialist ideologies or anti-capitalist ideologies are getting genuinely a lot of traction and that could actually translate to sort of seismic change?
Well, it could be. I think you're certainly right that that there has been a marked change in the United States in terms of what ideologies are more widespread. Like back in the 80s, 70s, 60s, 50s, et cetera, if you were an out and out avowed socialist, you know, that's kind of like stating that you have leprosy, you know, like you would be shunned from polite society. Whereas today, the favorability of socialism versus capitalism is actually higher among young people, according to several polls. It's still fairly close, but young people have a higher opinion of socialism than capitalism. But of course, the question is, what do they understand by socialism? If you're talking about a population like the US that is not very politically informed, you know, you have to wonder what exactly people are thinking of when they hear socialism. But nonetheless, what you're describing is true. There is this growth, and it's still, I think, very early to tell what is going to happen there, if it's going to grow further or what have you. I think that the demographics, just the, have you heard of the Planck principle in science, where science progresses one funeral at a time? Because older people don't tend to change their ideas even in the face of better evidence. You just have to wait for the old scientists to die off, and the new scientists will adopt a better, superior theory. Well, I think that's also going to describe the United States as well. As the older generations die off, the younger generations, with their much more, they're much more open to socialist ideas, like, you know, greater wealth taxation, more government intervention in the economy to help the poorest, et cetera. But you know, we'll see. I think what's clearer, I can't really predict beyond the kind of demographic Planck principle sort of argument. But what is clear to me, at least, is the reason for this. And I think it's two main reasons. One is the neoliberal era, where government basically allowed the accumulation of more and more wealth in fewer and fewer hands. Jobs were lost, good jobs were lost, jobs are worse and worse and worse, rents are higher. Basically, the standard of living has dropped significantly. College is more expensive, et cetera. So you have the economic system crushing younger people in particular, but not just younger people, more, and making life worse for people on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have the development of the internet, where now people have a much wider array of information, array of political perspectives and arguments than they could ever have reasonably expected to be, you know, to encounter back in the era where you only had newspapers, TV, radio. So I think the combination of those two developments is behind the greater popularity of socialism among the younger generations, and the success of the very few members of Congress that are more left-ish, like the squad.
So do you think we will see a radical shift in US politics? And perhaps, like you say, you know, as more of the old people start dying out and more young people become eligible voters, do you think a time is upon us, a time is coming soon where yes, the Republicans will be a right-wing party, but the Democrats will actually be a left-wing proper party, perhaps akin to the Labour Party, Jacinda Ardern's party in New Zealand?
Well, that's I as much as I wish that were very likely to be the case. I mean, we just have to look at the 2016 and 2020 Democratic primaries. There was a very strong showing. We came very close to getting Sanders the nomination, but the forces aligned against that kind of a shift are still quite powerful. And until we have a fundamental shift in the media system, whereby especially older voters, who are primarily the audience for your MSNBC, CNNs, et cetera, unless they get a more diverse media diet, I just see, at least in the next electoral cycle and maybe even the one after that, I think they'll still dominate. And one development over just the past year or two that has worried me a bit is you start to see some big divisions opening up within the very small left. you know, the actual politically aware activist contingent that was the kind of volunteer army behind the Sanders campaign, the primary reason why he outperformed beyond anyone's expectations in early 2016 or even early 2020. There's a split now. A lot of people think that electoral politics are a dead end. They're very disappointed in the squad because the squad isn't using its limited but very real power in the current state of Congress to really fight back in a more radical way. So there's a lot of division now among the left in the U.S., and that also worries me. If that means that the kind of volunteer army that really did power the Sanders campaign in the past, if that volunteer army is no longer there because half of those people are disaffected, they think that electoralism is a dead end, then, you know, that would kind of counteract the trend towards the left among the within Democratic primaries. So it's really hard for me to tell. I certainly hope that that's the case, but I'm not so sure.
And on that note, Peter, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
All right. Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Assistant Professor Peter Beattie. He's a lecturer in global political economy at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. If you missed any part of the show, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or Spotify, Apple Podcasts, pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Today I Learned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.